Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the editors and writers at strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of the events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, and your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com. Also, we'll be chatting with Austin Bay, author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Jim and Austin are working on the fourth edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War that will be published shortly. Jim and Austin, you're getting ready to publish your Quick and Dirty Guide to War, the fourth edition of it. And basically, one of the things that you've done is you've compiled a database of ranking all the different military out there. And it's been very, very popular on the site. What was your methodology for doing that?
Well, a lot of it just came from doing Strategy Page every day. You know, Austin and I, between us, you know, we cover all the ongoing wars, and that is the core of the How to Make War books. This is the fourth edition, and all we've done to all those editions, even without Strategy Page, is simply to keep track of what's going on in the world. It's become a lot easier since we've, 9 years since we've started, been doing Strategy Page, because it's all written down right there. It's not a matter of, going through old notes and things you might have jotted down, 3 or 4 years ago. And then, you just update. It's fairly simple now. God bless the internet.
Well, right. Dan, you're really asking, though, about the quantitative measurement of the Armed Forces database, aren't you?
Yeah, that's what I'd like to know about.
A lot of those, you can look at Jim's How to Make War, but the methodology using that, Jim is primarily responsible for putting that particular component of the book put together, but we're using what are really, I would call, classical basic assessments, number of troops, types of equipment, but then where it really becomes useful, though, there's judgments involved in it. Talk about tradition, training, leadership; those go into it. And ultimately, when you're putting together the a comparative database, because as you know, that's one of the things that I see occasionally in comments coming back on Strategy Pages. Bay, you and Dunnigan sure spend a lot of time talking about leadership, or there's a lot of stuff in there about talking about tradition and levels of training. And because if you've got highly trained personnel, there are all kinds of things you can accomplish. It's not non-denigrating equipment by any means, but
that aspect of military force has been underappreciated for a long, long time, even down in the Pentagon. There's long been a bias against what they like to call the soft factors. But, you talk to the top people and they will, tell you that those are the critical factors. In fact, in the last 20 or 30 years, and I've been around that long, working with the Pentagon, they've come to accept it, but they still can't quite get their arms around it because they are soft factors. Now, what we do in the book is we assign a number. Now, that annoys some people. How can you assign a number? I said, well, basically, you can assign a number to anything. People who have, in the modeling business, whether it's people who just play, the hardcore war games, what they call now strategic games, or people who professionally, model whatever, marketing, finance, they understand that you can assign a number, and of course you have to massage that number, play with many different numbers, and the numbers we put in the database are basically numbers based upon decades of experience. In other words, there's a lot behind them. And when you read Strategy Page every day, you will see articles. For example, there's an article in today's issue, as it were, of Strategy Page on the curse of leadership. And what that is a simply an explanation of why some armies have excellent armed forces and others have not so excellent armed forces. And I dug around and I realized that one of the key links, people always want, an example. What does that compare to? And actually, the thing it compares to most, you know, good military power is economic power. In other words, nations that have figured out how to educate their people, develop good leadership at all levels from the, you know, foreman up to the CEO, and basically create a lot of wealth for the people, they can also create very competent armed forces. And when you think about that, well, yeah, that does go together. And when you look at the countries that have bad armed forces, there are exceptions. Some, the armed forces is the only organization in the institution, so to speak, in the country, that basically educates and disciplines and leads, on a high level of performance its people. Pakistan, for example, the military is one of the most efficient organizations in the country, which is terrible because the economy, the business world, the government in general needs some of that discipline, but they just can't seem to get it. But you look at all the countries that have, armed forces or armed forces that are basically, better off if they were not there at all, they all suffer from economic problems as well.
Right. Now, people can go look at...
It may seem a bit tangential, but it's not. I think it actually elaborates on the point Jim just made. Okay. I recall an interview with Anwar Sadat, and I want to say it was the late 1970s, before he was murdered. And he was trying to explain to the interviewer that the Egyptian military was, in many cases, the only route up to a high government position for poor boys and lower middle class boys, because this was a route where leadership and competency were at some level within the military rewarded, and the interviewer just didn't understand what he was trying to tell her sociologically about the Egyptian military.
Yeah, Westerners take a meritocracy for granted.
Yeah, well, that's part of what was going on. And I remember thinking, Sadat is trying to describe to this reporter really what is the situation that obtains in, about 70% of the planet? Because a military security organization doesn't mean that it ultimately is... rises above mediocrity itself or subpar, but in order to function at a minimal level, they have to have competent and tactically and operationally competent soldiers, and they have to have leaders able to operate at that level. And you can't just go around giving somebody a plum job based on who their cousin is or who they know or how much cash they paid your political party in the military, or it's not going to work. And Sadat was giving a very sophisticated answer to this particular interviewer that and the interviewer just did not follow what he was saying. Jim was touching on that when he talked about military organizations and some of these desperately bad off third world countries. Money is not as bad off as Pakistan, but the military provides a structure there that's also a sociological, I don't want to put it this way, it's also an educational structure is what it amounts to.
Yeah. Well, often they have to, educate their own people. You have a terrible situation in Pakistan, for example, where in the tribal areas, the literacy rate is less than 20%. It's 3 or 4% for women. But they recruit the boys, into the army, or the boys go looking to volunteer. And, a lot of these young, Pashtun, guys find out that, they can only go so far until they learn how to read and write. And the army provides for that. They'll provide schools. I mean, the lowest ranking soldiers, you can teach them how to use a gun. And, do the basic things of soldiering without knowing how to read and write. But if you want to become an NCO, you got to be able to read and write. And that's a path, for advancement. Unfortunately, the young Pashtun guy finds out that may get him ahead, in the army, but he goes back to his tribe. He's still so-and-so, son of so-and-so, and not particularly well off. So the curse of the army in third world countries is that it becomes an island of Western meritocracy and achievement in a sea of tradition. And to our, you know, our, as far as Westerners are concerned, backwardness. And, you know, this is how the study of military history and military affairs can tell you a lot about everything else, because the big problem in poor countries generally is lack of opportunity for people who want to get rich. In other words, entrepreneurs haven't got a chance. Everything is already locked up. This is nothing new in human history. I mean, thousands of years ago, there were, you know, for example, the Indian caste system was basically set up to get things organized by making every job hereditary. So when they froze the structure in that point year, you know, thousands of years ago, you know, 20% of the population were stuck in the lowest caste, and, you know, until they converted to Islam or Christianity or just immigrated, they were stuck there forever. And this is an extreme example, but it's common of what happens in many cultures, and that's why immigrants to, like, the United States or to Europe in general, but especially to the United States, do so well. You know, this is amazing. You know, it's like, hey, you take anybody from around the world, put them in the United States, and they get rich. I mean, by standards back in the old country, but they tend to do very well in the United States. Most Native Americans don't see that. But if you look at the statistics, it's very telling. And of course, the reason is these people are coming into a new culture where there's not as many obstacles as they faced back home. And of course, the word gets around, and that's why you find, you know, families tending to come over, because, you know, one guy tells his cousin, he says, hey, yeah, it works. That's for me. Let's pay the snakehead, as they do in China, $20,000-$30,000 to come over. I mean, most Americans can't comprehend. How can that be worth it? Well, you've got to be somebody coming from a poor country, coming to, you know, the country where the streets are paved with gold. For some people, they literally are.
All right. Now, one of the things.
Let me make one more point too.
Okay, go ahead.
Way we assembling the databases. We've talked a lot about some of the so-called softer components right here. I talked about history, social advancement, the points that Jim making about the economies and economic organization. But we do include, of course, as best we can, open source material on actual strengths, unit structures, and the like, to produce that database. But, you know, it's what we're describing is a very, very rich and nuanced database that gives some people useful information to compare military power.
Yeah, it also gives some people some heartburn. People don't see the feedback we get. But there's the upcoming nationalism in some of these places that get very offended when their country's not number one in their region.
Well, see, these are the people who would argue no matter what you said, no matter what the number was. If they're not number one, there's something wrong with it. And there's basically no arguing with people like that, because the basis of their statements, their beliefs, are faith. And you cannot argue with faith.
That is correct.
Don't even try. Yeah. By definition, you can't shake it. But a lot of those same people from those same countries, you read, you know, sometimes I go over to those bulletin boards when I get an email, and I find there are some people trying to say, but wait a minute, you know, we do have problems in, you know, our infrastructure, or, you know, hey, our military tradition isn't the greatest, and they get shouted down because the people who are speaking from faith tend to have much louder voices.
Let me offer them something of a little bit of an olive branch. Remember, these are numbers, and they are aggregated. They're aggregates. Let me go from here's a qualitative and non-quantitative based assessment. Virtually all of these armed forces, components of them, if they're on the defensive and they're in their terrain, and it's tough terrain, and that tough terrain, Dan, could be, there are varieties of tough terrain, big cities, swamps, mountains, everything, arguably, I'm saying this with a little bit tongue-in-cheek, everything except a big parking lot where you can see everyone move. Everybody, these forces could put up a stout and significant defense. So they're not, but just the rating says, well, the rating came in lower. Oh, we're saying you guys are weak. No, that's not the context of what this chart does.
Yeah, we have to go over to the, we have a strategy page, we have the War Games Handbook, which has a chapter, a couple of pages actually, explaining how that works You know, how you take a basic value for combat, you know, value of an entire nation, how you break it down for whether or not you're just defending your border or trying to invade, you know, somebody 5,000 miles away. As Austin points out, it makes a big difference.
Offensive operations are, especially I'm talking about offensive operations, long-range offensive operations, you know, what we call the strategic distances and the like, those are very, very complex, and now you're down to only a handful of countries that can carry that out. There are a number of countries, and you mentioned Russia as an example. Russia, on its own periphery, and it has some limited long-range reach, of course, and I'm not here talking strictly about bomber and missile forces, of course.
Well, we do point that out in the database, in the book. And the version we have, the thing in the book came from Strategy Page, that most of the military power, as described in the charts, is local.
Yeah.
And that's the simplest way to put it. These guys are...
You saw that.
Exactly. These guys are basically there to either oppress their own people, which a lot of them unfortunately do, or simply to defend the borders, which a lot of them can do. I mean, you saw that in the 1980s with the Iran-Iraq war. Iraq tried to invade Iran. They really couldn't do it. They fell back, and after 7 years of very bloody fighting, they proved that they could defend their border, but that was about it, and they barely managed to pull that off. That is a very typical pattern, and most of the wars you see around the world today are basically internal disorder and raiding. You know, what's going on in Chad, what's going on in Darfur, what's going on in the Congo, you know, what's going on any place where there's shooting going on. It's not war in the grand historical sense of armies forming up with thousands of tanks and guys with fairly neat uniforms marching off. No, it's a bunch of guys skulking around, you know, in a residential area or out in the woods, you know, taking pot shots at one another. It's not very glorious. And it's not that difficult to count.
Now, people can go look at the data, but one of the things is that the data doesn't necessarily show is who out there is starting to get their act together. Who is, you know, up and coming?
Well, we did put a trend. You know, I was thinking of doing a whole section on that, but the book was long enough. We do have in the bit we did on Strategy Page last month, we published our new database almost 2 months ago.
Yes.
And we did a bit where I included a section. It's at the end of the text where I basically describe the situation region by region. And I give some historical context to that. But the one thing I discovered while doing that, I mean, I did that for that purpose, you know, to show, you know, less so a little bit of where the trends are. The trends don't change. The big, for example, in Europe, I would say, oh, let's see what's going on, how things have changed. Because the last time we did this was, 5 years ago or something, like 5 or 6 years, last time we updated that database. Not only have they not changed much from 5 years ago, but they hadn't changed much from the end of the Cold War or before that. The up-and-comers, we do tend to cover fairly frequently in Strategy Page. For example, China is an up-and-comer. A lot of coverage of China. It's not because we're down on China or because we're headline hounds. It's just a fact of life. For another example, which is perhaps more prescient, is India. India is not something that attracts a lot of headlines in the West. People take India for granted. But India gets about as much coverage as China because India is also growing in military power. And, of course, we also cover the countries that are declining, like North Korea, whereas South Korea, which gets a lot of coverage as they add new capabilities, we cover them. So without putting a graph in there, which I think is what you're talking about and some people would like, and we just haven't got the time to maintain something like that, we do cover who's going up and who's going down.
Right. And, you know, one of the things is people sometimes doubt your guys' ability to predict this stuff. But one of the things that I'd like to bring up from a historic perspective is it was you two that predicted the low casualty rates in the first Gulf War. You were the only ones that come out and actually predict that.
Well, the game showed that. The game that mainly Austin designed had a very low casualty rate, although the game didn't predict casualties, you know, in a digital sense. But you know, he said, you know, he did the first test and he came back to me and said, Keith, you know, we really stop. And what do you think, Jim? And I thought about it. I looked at the numbers, you know, and I said, well, I'd seen that before. In 1973, we were doing a hypothetical game on an Egyptian-Israeli war, which turned out to be the 1973 war. It happened, you know, about the time the game was published. And I'll never forget, we were looking there, we sat it all set up and said, all right, let's see what the Egyptians could do at the bar level line. They blew right past it. And I said, wait a minute, the Israelis are supermen. But then the kids, you know, people looking on the project, did the numbers again. It says, no, Jim, they only got this much up there. The Egyptians got this much. And, you know, look at the probabilities. They blew right past them. Well, deja vu. Same thing happened in 1990. And it was Austin, a guy coming to me saying, well, are these numbers right?
Look, here's, I went through very detailed as I was building the larger game. Six iterations of what I thought was the most likely, line of attack on Iraqi positions in Kuwait. They were all left hooks. Every one of them was a left hook. I mean, you can see, I think it's the October 3rd or October 2nd, Nightline 1990, where Jim and I are on Nightline.
Yeah, and Koppel is saying, is that true? Is that what they're really going to do?
Right.
And I think look, it's the textbook solution. There is no other way to do it.
Well, all right, but the thing is, I also had, and I think I've still got it somewhere, I had, because I know I've got one of the old staff officers' texts in here with lots of logistics and casualty data in it, but I had a photocopy of some of the casualty prediction or assessment data from the old staff officer's manual, and I had an envelope, literally an envelope, Dan, where every time I would have an American brigade group encounter a Iraqi, we modeled them basically as Iraqi corps, otherwise it's just been too many of these midget little divisions all over the place, in engagement, and see what the results were. There was some great Kentucky windage involved in this because of the overwhelming air power. Basically, I put this in trying to describe it for the gamers out there. Let's say I had a armor brigade, an American armor brigade, and moving along with it would be two on-call close air support jets. So it's essentially they're moving with an A-10s or whatever. And it was just overwhelming. Essentially, especially Iraqi units that if you played with what I thought was the most likely option, which is that you actually had three options in there about the level of resistance that one of these Iraqi corps could put up. It was a rule written specifically to say, if you really think these guys are going to hang on like the French Foreign Legion, all right, then do it this way. But I'm going to tell you, only the French Foreign Legion and a handful of other outfits like that are going to pull this to the last man kind of action. And there was a little bit of cheekiness involved with it, but it was the point was is that it was not just a component here of training and morale, but tradition was going to take you up. And I said, these guys don't have that. These are many of these are, you know, Shia draftees fighting for Saddam. Well, we understand that, and then I go fine. So I kept an ongoing chart. And I did this several times, and consistently I would get, because with the level of aggregation, you could not get down to, how many get hit there and elsewhere. But we'd have between, what I would estimate, between 1,000 and 1,500, coalition dead. Now that was an estimate. One of the reasons that it would sometimes be a little bit higher is because I know this is where my own experience as an armor officer would come into play, because if you will recall, after Desert Storm was over, there was an incident that involved a 24th Mechanized Infantry Division and a part of an Iraqi armor brigade that was lost and didn't know the war was over. And in about 5 minutes, That was the 24th that Mac destroyed, I think it was 60 or 70 Iraqi vehicles in a shootout that didn't need to take place, but did take place, and the Iraqis finally surrendered. Casualties in that, I forgot, were not all that high, but that could have been. Well, that kind of incident could have occurred with an Iraqi unit in the desert moving, running into the rear of an American armor unit, and you would have had a spike in casualty. So, but anyway, we're consistently coming out with 1,000, 1,500. Now, there is someone else who did a much finer model, and he deserves credit, and it's Trevor DeGary.
Trevor? Yeah.
Trevor's hero model, I think, is one of the, this is a use, and this is a, ought to go into modeling legend. If you recall that Les Aspin, in January of 1991, held hearings at the House Armed Services Committee, and he featured Colonel DePuy. And Colonel DePuy got up there and said that we'll be around, I believe, you can see it, since C-SPAN has all this on videotape. I think he said 450 or 480 dead.
Yes.
Now, he's been running his model, and of course it is a highly...
And that took everybody's breath away. You know,
yeah.
Al and I were on CNN just about that time promoting a new book we had at that time. And they spent 10 minutes on the book, and then they quickly shifted to, this is in, December, 1990. And I said, well, what about the million-man, battle-hardened Iraqi desert army? I said, well, that's three lies in one sentence. And she kind of looked at me. I said, yeah. I said, they're not battle-hardened or shell-shocked. They're not a million men. They're more like 600,000. And this is all stuff that's available in the public record. And they're not a desert army. During the Iran-Iraq war, they fought in the swamps or the mountains. Not in the desert. But the point was, the media was inventing fantasies, which they're still doing, and feeding them back to themselves. I mean, I was on another show, and they asked me point blank, is there any chance we can lose? And I said, none whatsoever, zero. And they kind of looked at me incredulously, because they'd all been pumping themselves up with this, oh, my God, it's going to be dangerous, it's going to be a bloodbath, et cetera, et cetera. And they're still doing it. They're always looking for a way to make something look a little more exciting than it actually is. In their way of thinking, and they're right from a promotional point of view, victory is dull. Whereas defeat is a disaster, and that makes a bigger headline. But it is accurate. It is not the way the world works. Things basically happen for a reason. And if you don't look at and study the reasons, which is what we do in our book and which we do at Strategy Page, you're not going to understand what's really going on.
Well, let me get another point too about what Jim and I had produced our estimate, and you can see some of this on television, but also in the way when the initial version of Kuwait War was published in December of 1990. So we had our number out there, and the only thing that was lower and ultimately more accurate was Colonel DePuy, the DOD gave him access, as well they should, and he ran his model, and then he got to testify, and Aspin set it up, and DePuy had, here's an example of a modeler having the political effects that Les Aspin wanted, and I listened very carefully to Colonel DePuy's testimony, because heck, I'm a war gamer and modeler myself, and I said, okay, I know what he's doing, he's got, and the thing is, great, I hope you're right, and you know what, I can say, heck, I said this then, I think there's a good chance he's going to be right. Well, he was. And I'm proud of what Jim and I did, because look, nobody else was coming in with numbers like that. And we're on TV and radio saying, this is the way it's going to go. It's not going to be this morass and dying in the, trenches filled with oil. We're not stupid. You had to tell some of these guys. I remember saying that, as a matter of fact. Excuse me, why do you think we're stupid and we're going to attack into somebody's defenses?
Right.
What?
Now, Austin, would you mind?
The other big unknown was that we couldn't quantify was the American Army had gone through two decades or a decade and a half of reforms after Vietnam, and they had not been in combat since then. Everybody knowledgeable of military affairs knew that these guys were trained to a higher level. And the big question mark was, how much more effective would they be? Well, we found out. That's why nobody predicted the casualties as low as they actually were, because nobody, believe that the quality of the troops would have gotten up as high as it did. And the same thing happened in Iraq, where the casualty rate is a third of what it was in Vietnam. And that gives you a sense of, you know, how much better, much more capable the troops are in Iraq and Afghanistan than they were in Vietnam.
Would you remind the listeners, Austin?
Dan, just for a second.
Okay.
Nobody. Well, yeah, Jim and Austin did, and Colonel Dupuy even did a little bit better, but that was it. You had three guys with military backgrounds and a lot of experience in gaming trying to say, take a look at this. And also, one of the things that I know Jim talked about all the time, especially he was on there with on NBC, was one of the things is, what are the effects of Fort Irwin, meaning the National Training Center? Well, guess what? National Training Center was a real boon, wasn't it, Jim?
Yep, changed everything.
Now, would you remind the people of what everybody else was saying so they can see the comparison between the numbers?
20,000, 30,000. Yeah.
Enormous numbers of dead.
Yeah.
Right.
Casualties.
And everybody thought you guys and Colonel Dupuy were nuts when you came out with your numbers.
Not everybody, but some people did, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and they still do. I mean, you know, the Iraq war comes around, Afghanistan comes around, and sometimes I'm in front of the same, you know, talent on air, and some of them even remember what I said, you know, earlier. And somehow they think, you know, what I predicted back then was a fluke. Actually, you know, without naming names, some of them understand what I'm talking about. A lot of them are just, as the British say, newsreaders, and that's all they should stick to. But, you know, the news business is predicated upon screaming headlines that attract eyeballs. That's how you make your money.
Yeah.
So really, there's no money in historical accuracy. So every time I go on, and I don't go on as much anymore because I got tired of it, it's basically a challenge. How do I get some reality through the need for, you know, something spectacular?
Yeah. And
that's the problem in the news business in general.
And what I wanted to bring out here with talking about the historical, where you guys have predicted numbers and like that, is that we're not just a couple of bloggers that got together and we were interested in military affairs. We've got a track record of being right at Strategy Page.
Oh, sure. Now, that's the beauty of the Internet. I mean, and if you don't believe us, as some paranoid people will not, you can go to the Wayback Machine, you know, the Internet Archive, where they capture, you know, because we will update some things. You know, if people find an egregious error, we have an editing facility, we'll go back. But it's usually very recent stuff. It's stuff that's 8, 9 years old. It's as it was written back then, and it's captured in the Internet Archive, and you can go there and see. We said this, for example, go back to, you know, this time 7 years ago, what we were saying. We've been reporting regularly on Afghanistan, you know, for years before, 2001. And so it was no surprise to us what happened. And there are plenty of examples there. What happened in Iraq, you know, with the years of irregular warfare, no surprise if you were reading Strategy Page. And that's why we have, you know, 500,000 users. But the majority of people get their news from headlines because they haven't got time. Even Strategy Page, as concise as it is, you know, it can take you, you know, half an hour, 40 minutes to plow through everything we put out every day. Most people haven't got that much time. They grab the headline. They watch the evening news. That's all they know. There's not much you can do about it. But if you do want to know what's going on and you have got, you know, 20, 40 minutes a day to spare, you know, just come by Strategy Page. And just by listening to this podcast, you've increased your military IQ by God knows how much.
That's right. Well, I think that's a good...
on that, I think I'm going to have to go here.
Okay. So. Well, I think that's a great place to wrap up.
That is. All right.
Next week.
Okay. Bye, guys. Next week. Bye.